and there's a rope ladder, and you'd have to jump. We're being cowards, really. I break down and cry, like a baby.
Conversations, an occasional Radio Moments series in which we talk to those who made a difference. Tony Prince.
It was a different kind of radio. It was a gramophone, if I remember rightly, a very long thing, a long cabinet with a wireless in the middle of it. And you opened the lid at the top and there was a record player with a multi-dropping kind of Dansetti setup where you put 10 records and they drop down one at a time. 78s, if I remember rightly. And it was something my parents cherished more than I as a kid. And the only time I ever really saw it working in the early days was when they'd come home on Saturday night from the pub with all their friends. I suppose they were the party people of the 50s. I'd be woke up, come down, the only kid in a grown-up environment with lots of bottles of beer around the place and people singing. And occasionally they'd stop singing and put Radio Luxembourg on because it was nighttime. And there was no Elvis yet or anything like that. But my goodness, I just fell in love with radio at that point. You know, the magic of 208 coming out with these wonderful tunes.
This is Radio Luxembourg, your station of the stars, broadcasting on 208 meters medium wave. It's time for Top 20. Hi, everybody. This is your DJBA Barry Aldis at the microphone. It's great to be with you.
I'd go to Butlins with my parents and I'd wander into the Rock and Calypso ballroom and hear these tunes. Bobby Darin, Dream Lover, and Sugar Shack, Jimmy Gilmer and the Fireballs, and Elvis. And these were all thrown at me in 57, 58, and, you know, they really were the big influence rather than radio, was listening to records in a ballroom.
Oh, there's a crazy little shack beyond the tracks.
I was too young to go out dancing in Oldham, but somehow or other I managed to get a job at the Princess Ballroom. And I'd gone in there and spoke with the manager. I said, you know, I'm only 15, but I'd love to come in here, you know. And he said, well, you can't, you see, we've got licensed premises. But if you'd like to go down this corridor here, we've got the DJ booth where we play records when the big band has a break. He said, and if you want to come down and play those records on Saturday night, I'll give you free admission and a half a crown. That sounded pretty good to me. So that was my first stint at being a DJ. It was a strange gig, really, because you couldn't see the audience. You just had to hope you were making them dance, really. The Rock and Calypso Ballroom had now become the Rock and Jive Ballroom. And one day I walked in and there was this guy I recognised polishing his cowboy boots. So I bought myself a milkshake and I went and sat down next to him. He was on his own. I introduced myself, Tommy Whitehead from Oldham, before I had a stage name. Hello, Tommy. I said, I just love Rory Storm and the Hurricanes. He was the drummer in the band. He was Ringo Starr. And I said how much I loved the whole idea of singing with a band. He said, well, why don't you get up in the talent competition? So I said to him, I'll get up and sing if you lend me a cowboy boots. So that night of the competition started. I'm at the side of stage now and Ringo looked at me and he pointed to the left-hand side of the stage, a couple of cowboy boots, pair of cowboy boots. So I put them on. I felt cool, you know. So I sang Bebop-a-Lulu in C. I've got the cowboy boots on. I'm pretending I'm Gene Vincent.
Well, Bebop-a-Lulu, she's my baby.
I've got the mic in front of me with the stand going down at 45 degree and I'm swaying with, well, Bebop-a-Lulu, and all this crowd in front. I mean, it's Oldham Wakes. They're all Oldhamers, you know. So I've got the crowd on my side, you know, and I'm tiny and I'm cheeky and I'm giving it the Gene Vincent. Now, when Gene Vincent got to the middle eight, he'd kick his right leg over the mic stand and somehow he'd finish up with it behind his back. He's now holding the microphone at 45 degrees behind his back, and I wanted to do that. I tried it loads of times with a broom in my mum and dad's bedroom, you know, in front of the mirror. I knew I could do this. So, go man! And we got to the middle eight, go man! And I kicked my leg in the air, and of course Ringo's cowboy boots were far too big for me. And it came off, flew through the air, and landed on a teddy boy's head. At the same time, I didn't quite make my kick over the microphone. The microphone fell on the stage with a boom, and I fell off the stage with a scream. So the audience are just killing himself laughing. The group can't play anymore through laughing. Ringo's head hits the, you know, the drum kit, and Johnny Guitar, as the lead guitarist is called, just sat down on the floor. It was just a really, really great pivotal moment in my life when I made an audience cry laughing, and I came second in the competition. But this really impacted on me, my first taste of audience. The adrenaline that goes with knowing you've done something that pleased so many people. And anyway, a bunch of guys came up to me and said they were forming a group in Oldham and they were looking for a singer. So the Jasons were born. By this time, I'd got back from the Gerald Armstrong stable in Yorkshire, which was my first job. When I left Oldham Art School at the age of 15, I didn't know what to do. A girl in the class said, "Well, why don't you be a jockey? You're the right size." So she gave me some addresses to write to and blow me down. The Gerald Armstrong stable wrote back and said they'd offer me an apprenticeship. So for 6 months, I was up there on the Yorkshire moors every morning on these big stallions. But I packed in after 6 months. I didn't like the cold weather in December up there on the Yorkshire moors, and I came home. And that's when I met the Jasons. I'm an apprentice toolmaker now, and I'm working with metal all day and overalls on. And at night, I'm singing with the Jasons, and we're touring all the Manchester gigs. We're resident at the Oldham Savoy, which was a big gig then. We were doing all the really great venues around Manchester, along with bands like the Hollies and Herman's Hermits and all those bands. And we were getting pretty good. And then we got offered a Butlin's season. And I wanted to take it with both hands because it meant I could throw my micrometer away and become a professional singer, which is all I wanted. The other boys wouldn't turn professional. So that's when I left the Jasons and the band broke up and I went solo. And then one night I got an invite to go to a new ballroom that was opening in Oldham. And I had a date with a young lady who'd come up to see me from Manchester. So I'm drinking orange juice and she's got a baby sham on the go. And we're standing at the bar, we've watched the band, a 15-piece orchestra. And I knew the band leader, he's called Johnny Francis. And he came over to the bar and he asked me what I was doing. And I said, "Well, I've gone solo. The Jasons have broke up." He said, "You're joking." He said, "Tommy, we want a lead singer. Are you interested in joining my band?" "Oh, am I interested?" Suddenly, you know, I'm like an apprentice toolmaker getting £4 a week. He's offering me 16 quid a week to become a full-time professional singer. So, of course, I grabbed it with both hands, joined the Johnny Francis Orchestra. And then one other big night in my life, very influential. You know when you can turn left to right? One night the manager came up to me and says, "Tommy," he said, "would you play the records when the band have a break? I'll pay you another 5 quid a week." God, blimey, I'm on 21 quid a week now. Life was great. And then along came Gary Brown. And Gary Brown was the man in charge of the music output for the entire Top Rank circuit, which was quite extensive. He came to see us and he said, "I want you guys to open a new venue in Bristol." So it didn't need much thinking for me because he's offering us pay rises. And he also said, "Tommy," he said, I don't want you to go down to Bristol as Tommy." I was Tommy Prince, by the way. The Prince came when I was in the Jasons, but I was still Tommy Prince. He said, "I want you to become Tony." He said, "That's got a much nicer ring. It's cooler than Tommy. You're going south now. You're not Tommy from Oldham anymore." So I bought into that. And we went down and we went to the Top Rank in Broadmead, Bristol. And I had the most wonderful 3 years of my life living in that city. A lot of things happened down there. The first thing was the Musicians Union Secretary came to see us to make sure that Rank were treating us well, giving us the right terms. I was doing so many gigs. I was really earning that money. You know, I've still got the contract. I'm professional. I'm living in Bristol. You know, girls are appearing in my life for the first time. It was just an incredible time. Then this damn secretary comes to see us for the Musicians Union. And he says to me, "Tony," I'm Tony now, "I don't think they're paying you enough. Look at all these sessions you're doing. You're DJing as well as singing and playing guitar." So I said, "Well, great, get me more money." 2 weeks later, I get a letter from him, brown envelope, and stamped in red on front of it, "Keep Music Live. Dear Tony, It's been brought to my attention that you're breaking union rules. Keep music live. We do not support records in ballrooms, and we have to ask you to stop playing records. And Top Rank used me as a scapegoat to test this law. It was important to them. They wanted records in ballrooms, not because it was cheaper. Before records, they'd have a trio give the big band a break. Gary told me years later it was nothing to do with paying one guy to play records rather than three musicians. It was because the public wanted it. They wanted that pure sound of the original artist. That's why we wanted records in ballrooms. So they used me as a scapegoat. There was a big meeting in Bristol Sunday afternoon, and they brought all the Musicians' Union members. I was well outnumbered. The union made their points. Gary Brown made his points. Johnny Francis said, if you don't keep Tony in the union, I promise you this, we'll be lucky if we're here in a couple of years' time. You've got to embrace people like Tony. And I stood up. I said, I don't know why you don't keep me in the union. I am a musician. You know, and I've got to tell you something. Every DJ is going to be a musician. Their love and passion for music. They might not be able to play chords, but their love for music. I think you should bring them into the union, and then you can control how many records they play. Then you can control records. But they didn't listen. They threw me out, and I was expelled from the union. And after a little while, I just became the DJ. Top Rank had said, if I go to the tribunal, if we would call it that, they will pay me the same wage that I was on doing all of the gigs, you know. And so we worked out a deal, and I was a wealthy young man all of a sudden, but I was no longer a singer guitarist. I was a DJ. And from that moment on, my whole life has been targeted being a great DJ and embracing the industry of the DJ. I've rather felt over the years I have an obligation to DJs. And if you map out my life after that point, you'll see it has been very dedicated to the art of the DJ. I was missing singing. And a manager of the Top Rank set up an agency. He said he'd like to manage me as a singer again. So they got me a Liverpool group, the Mersey Four. And we started doing gigs around the West Country. And then we got offered a gig. Things weren't going well at all. The management company wasn't great. And Jeff, who was running it, as a last resort, got us a gig in Hamburg at the Star Club where the Beatles had played. The other group members were really delighted. They thought it was a fantastic thing to do. I didn't fancy it one little bit. And I was also having trouble with my stomach. And we were doing a gig in, I think it was Chippenham or somewhere. And all these teddy boys in front of us, and we're doing a rock and roll set, and suddenly I stopped and I rainbowed over the audience in front of me. I was sick as a dog. I was rushed to hospital. I'm there for 2 weeks. It was a duodenal ulcer. So that got me out of the Hamburg gig, and I thought, well, let's go back to Top Rank as a DJ, which is what I did. But this time they put me in the north of England again, and I think I was an Exocet missile for Top Rank to get rid of Irving Tidswell's orchestra, who were terrible, you know. So I'm working up there, and then I get a telegram. You know, things happen. You just bear this in mind, whoever's listening to this. Tomorrow something extraordinary can happen. You never know in life. But this was really positive, this particular thing. I don't think they have telegrams anymore, but it was like something that was delivered to you urgently. And you opened the envelope, and inside was a cryptic message. And this one said, call Chris Mercer, Cardiff TWW telephone number. TWW is television for Wales and the West. But their head office was in Cardiff, although the Bristol studios is where Disagogo was produced. And I'm being called down there. I did an audition on the lawn. Now, everybody regards Ready Steady Go as the first audience participation show, where the band's alive and the audience is dancing. But in actual fact, it was this show in Bristol. And the reason they were looking for a presenter was because Kent Walton was going away to do commentary on wrestling for the Olympic Games.
And hello, grappling fans everywhere. Yes, this is quite a special occasion here this afternoon.
Wow, what a break. So there we are, he's agreed, I've got the job. Yeah, and it went well. At the end of the 4 weeks, Chris offered me a regular job, bantering with Kent Walton when he came back between groups. So yeah, it was a good regular gig, and I'm now back at the Top Rank in Bristol. So life was great. Then Chris asked me to do an extra job. He wanted me to be his librarian. I could go and buy records. I could be the A&R man for that venue. Now I'm being asked to be the A&R man for a major TV show. And there was no limit to the budget. I could buy whatever I wanted. And of course, record companies sent us a lot of free records. One day, one of those free records came from EMI, and it was Tony Blackburn. And the song was Don't Get Off That Train. And it wasn't a great record. I don't think Tony ever made a great record. He was okay. He too, I think, was a big band singer.
We're coming to the station now, but don't get off that train.
I've been reading the NME, the New Musical Express, and they keep talking about this pirate radio station, Radio Caroline. And I'm salivating reading these stories. I want to know what it's like. I can't hear it in Bristol. It's out of the signal reach. So I go to see Chris Mercer and say, Chris, listen, this isn't a record I would normally recommend, but it's all right, you'd get away with it. And he's a good-looking lad, looking at the photo they've sent us. But more importantly, he's one of the new breed DJs on the pirate ship Radio Caroline. So Chris was really keen now. He liked the idea of putting on somebody who was a pirate DJ. So I got Tony a gig on Disagogo. He did come to our studio, and he did tell me how I got a job on Radio Caroline, who to get in touch with.
They should re-release that one again at Christmas, shouldn't they? A Little Eva with Let's Turkey Trot. The time on Radio Caroline, Britain's first commercial radio station, 14 minutes to 6. Tony Blackburn here with All Systems.
Very shortly after that, Disagogo came to an end because Ready Steady Go had started to dominate all the regions. So Chris came to me and said, Tony, his days are numbered. I said, that's all right, Chris. I think I know what I want to do next. And what I did next was I got in touch with Chris Moore, who was the programme controller for Radio Caroline. He invited me down to London. He was impressed, you know. You don't get DJs coming to a pirate radio station who are coming off television. You know, it's usually the other way around. So I went down to London, and, I got the job.
You're tuned to Radio Caroline on 199, your all-day music station.
The first gig was on Caroline South. That meant we had to catch a train down to Harwich, and then we'd jump on a fishing boat. So it's just about 3.5 miles on the ship. A lot of the DJs were sick on that 3.5 mile. Maybe they could put up with it on the ship itself. But that little trip out on a small boat in choppy waters could really challenge you. And I remember on this occasion being with Tony Blackburn, travelling down together. We were buddies by now. And I think people like Paul Kay were going out to Radio London. We had John Peel on board, also going out to Radio London. Kenny Everett, and who's our DJs? Oh, Emperor Roscoe, Norman St. John, Graham Spider Webb, and we were all catching this boat. They'd go to London, we go to Caroline. And you didn't know what was going to happen. All you knew, you was going out to a pirate ship, but you know, you pull alongside with this fishing boat against these tires that are hanging down the side of Caroline, and there's a rope ladder, and you'd have to jump from the boat to the big boat. It was very dangerous, you know, and for the first time. So that was my arrival on the ship. I'd never done a radio show before, so I had a lot to learn. But I was surrounded by the right people to teach me. The reason there weren't that many English boys or British boys on pirate radio in the very early days was because there was nowhere you could get anyone with experience. So they inherited a lot of Americans, Canadians. So on the ship, you had people like Graham Webb, Norman St. John.
Number 26 this week in our Fab 40.
And they were just open arms for you to learn, to tell you little secrets about being a great DJ. You're not talking to a million people. You're talking to one person. And don't talk about you lot out there. Talk about you out there. And make it intimate. Those are the kind of things. And then the technical things like how to make jingles, how to edit tape. It was all a learning process. It was a real great apprenticeship.
No, Tony Print, watch it, lad. Watch it.
Hey, it's 20 minutes to
22 and a half minutes after 6 o'clock on a wonderful Sunday night here in Ramsey Bay. And I'd like to say hi for one of the final times to all the lovely folk enjoying a holiday on the glorious Isle of Man. We aren't having too good a summer.
You originally put me on Caroline South, and then one day Ronan O'Reilly was in the office with him listening to Radio Caroline, and I was on the air, and Ronan said, "What's he talking about? Can you understand him, Chris?" Because I had a northern accent, you know. And Chris said, "Yeah, he's from the north. I picked him up in Bristol. He was on television. He's great." And Ronan says, "You've put him on the wrong station, haven't you? He needs to be up on the North ship." So that was it. I was sent up to Caroline North, and I spent a year and a half up there. I nearly didn't. Something extraordinary happened. Because of Chris Mercer at Disagogo introducing me to Phil and Dorothy Solomons, who were agents for them, The Bachelors, Twinkle, and came down to Disagogo regularly, and Chris said to Dorothy Solomons, Phil's wife, "You should sign this young man, he's going to be a star." And that's how I became signed to the Dorothy and Phil Solomon agency in London. But when I'd been to see Chris Moore for this Caroline job, just as I was leaving his office, he said, "By the way, have you got a manager or agent?" I said, "Yeah, I'm with the Solomons agency." He said, "Come back in, shut that door." He said, "I'm sorry, Tony, I can't give you a gig if you're with them." He said, "I bloody hate Phil Solomon." He said, "Leave the contract with our solicitors, we'll get you out, okay?" And that's how I got the job. So I'm up on Caroline North now. I've done about 6 weeks or so, and I come off the ship, and I get home to Oldham. I'm living with my mum and dad when I get time off. And I got another telegram. "Phone Tom Lodge at Caroline House." Tom Lodge was a DJ on Caroline South who had become involved with programming in the London office. Now, in those days, it was a telephone box on the corner of Edgerton Street, and you'd have to keep putting shillings in, you know, and you'd have a pile of shillings because you didn't know how long a phone call was going to cost. Keep punting these shillings in, and then the beeps would go, and you put another shilling in. Anyway, I've got Tom Lodge now on the phone. He said, "I've got some bad news for you, Tony." He says, "You're not going back." I said, "What do you mean I'm not going back? Have you seen my mail?" I mean, I had sacks and sacks of mail. It was just phenomenal. The love, not just for me, but for Caroline and the atmosphere it was creating. This was the first time Britain had had 24-hour music on the radio. He said, "Yeah." He said, "I know you're getting a lot of mail." He said, "But unfortunately for you, Phil Solomon has just become a director of Radio Caroline." Gulp. "There's nothing I can do," he says. And that was it. I went home, tail between my legs. This great gig, and boy, did I love being a Caroline DJ. And there it was, just disintegrating before my eyes. I went home after Tom Lodge called me, and I got all my mail there, and I spent any money I had, my last wages from Caroline, on stamps and envelopes and writing paper. And I wrote to every fan who'd written to me, and I told them, in a short message, "Thank you for your lovely letter. Unfortunately, I've been fired. If you want to help me, how about dropping a line to Ronan O'Reilly?" I've got to get back on that ship. And then it came, the telegram, "Call Ronan's secretary." So I called Ronan's secretary, and she says, "Tony, can you get down here? Ronan wants to see you. He can't believe how many letters he's getting about you."
"Bachelor boy until my dying day." Well, I don't know about Mick, but I certainly am. Mick's going down in 10 minutes from now. Oh, dear, dear, dear.
The chemistry was fantastic. It was a lot of fun. I remember DLT on the South Ship. He could always tell jokes. He used to challenge us. He'd say, "Give me any subject and I'll give you a joke about that subject." So we were always trying to catch him out, you know. The downside was the milk went sour after 3 or 4 days. And if you were in a storm and you couldn't get ashore, the milk was off. So it became a little bit rough out there. And the food was Dutch. You used to have strange meals like nasi goreng or whatever it was called. Very greasy stuff. Rice with an egg in the middle. And so I didn't like the food. And then one day, something really extraordinary happened. We'd been off air. The engineer said there was a cable right at the top of the mast, 130 foot up in the air, that had come off, and it needed a technician to climb up the mast and release this cable. It was short-circuiting our broadcasting. So we've gone, and there's a storm, so they can't get out. The engineers can't get out. And we're rocking away there. We're sick in many respects, you know. And then one morning, it calms a little bit. Blackburn, Norman St. John and I agreed we were going to go up the ladder. We were going to climb up and we were going to put us back on air. What a hero you'd be. Put Caroline back on air. That was the intention. Tony was the first one to try. He got about halfway up and he came down. His hands were freezing. He said he wanted some gloves. Norman St. John went next. He went up about 20 rungs. He came down. Then I went up. And I went up to the point where Tony had been, halfway on the Caroline mast. You can imagine when they built the ship in Ronan O'Reilly's father's boatyard in Ireland, they had to put an extensive mast on. And this was done by welding a new mast to the original mast. You could see the weld, you know, going around the mast where they'd put it together. But the problem was the rungs were bigger than the ones below. And we'd had a safety harness with a clip. And you'd clip it over every rung you went up in case your hand slipped and you fell. So you'd just keep clipping, 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 but you got to the halfway point and the clip wouldn't fit over the rungs. So I came back down and then Tony Blackburn said, I'll have another go. He's got his gloves now, right? I warned him. I said, Tony, those rungs are too thick for the clip. He said, well, I'll go without the clip then. And my God, he went all the way up. I mean, when you get to the top, you know, this mast is swaying 20 foot that way, 20 foot that way. It's quite extraordinary, the courage of the boy. He released the cable, and it didn't fall all the way down. It stopped about three quarters of the way up, but he was exhausted, and he came down. I then went up, and I managed to get this cable cleared and down onto the deck. And as I was doing that, a good piece of fortune, Ronan O'Reilly was coming out on the tender. And of course, the captain of the ship made them stay away because if the fishing boat had banged against Caroline, it might have dislodged me. So they stood off at about, you know, 40 yards. And Ronan's watching me do this deed. He's missed Tony Blackburn, but he's seen me, you know, so I'm his hero.
Broadcasting. The Isle of Man has won a temporary reprieve in the battle against the British government over the application of the Marine Offences Bill to the Isle of Man by ordering council.
I think when the legislation got nearer and nearer, we never believed the government would do this. We couldn't believe it. I mean, the government, they must have known how loved the pirate ships were. Surely there was a better way than just making us lift anchor and come ashore. So we didn't really believe it, you know. So we were all busy going ashore, doing gigs. We're now doing gigs in clubs, earning lots and lots of money. Life was incredible for a Caroline or a London or a Scotland DJ. But then we started putting propaganda jingles together and voiceovers and messages condemning the Labour government. There were protest marches and there was all that going on.
Yes, the battle is on. And as part of it, Broadside's free radio fighters are building up the greatest ever petition on behalf of free radio in Britain. Through this petition, the nation can raise its voice to protest the government's action in steamrolling legislation against the wishes of 25 million Britons.
Tony Prince was thinking he was going to stay on the ship, fight the Marine Offences Act, rebel. But by this time, I'd got a new agent, Bunny Lewis, and he was managing all the big DJs, you know, Simon D. And he'd persuaded me, he said, you really don't stay on board. He said, you know, if you go to prison, you won't get a job anywhere. You certainly won't get a job at the BBC. What I did was I said to the listener, listen, you can help me to decide. My passion is to stay. My agent and common sense is to leave and try and forge a career. But I'll let you decide. If you send me a letter, tell me you want me to stay. If the majority of mail says stay, I promise you, I give you my word, I will stay.
Yes, it's exactly 7 o'clock, 1 hour to go on the Prince Tony Show, and then my final day on Radio Caroline tomorrow, so that's 1 hour and 1 day.
We came ashore on that day, DLT and I, Jerry King maybe, and as we came ashore, people like Daffy Donnellan, he's Canadian, so the bill's not going to affect him. and some English lads who get their first radio job, and they'll chance the law, you know, because they've never been on radio before. So good luck to them. So we passed ships in the night. They're going out to the ship. We're coming ashore. We're being cowards, really. And I must say, I did feel a bit like a coward.
Midnight approaches. It is August the 15th. Johnny Walker announces that Caroline belongs to you. That she loves.
So that night, we came ashore, and we went to the casino on the Isle of Man, the Palace Hotel. And DLT and I got very drunk. And that was my farewell to Caroline. And I was waiting now to see whether I got on BBC Radio 1 or Radio Luxembourg. They were the only two gigs in the world. Robin Scott from Radio 1. And he just reassured me that they'd got a quota to start the launch. But be patient, Tony. We'll find a place for you. Well, that was encouraging. And then Bunny Lewis called me and said, Radio Luxembourg want you. So I joined Radio Luxembourg. When you joined Radio Luxembourg back then, you're on a three-month trial. The boss was a guy called Geoffrey Everett, who'd been a DJ in Luxembourg himself.
I think I started actually on the 2nd of June, 1946.
So you went out there and you were met by my old friend Paul Kay, who'd been a newsreader on Radio London. I'd seen him on the Tenderer quite a lot. The only other guy who'd gone out there in the new breed DJs was Paul Burnett. I was the next in line. And Paul Kay met me at the airport, welcomed me to Luxembourg. He was our newsreader. We had the luxury of a newsreader. Later, we all started reading the news ourselves. But Paul, God bless him, he was a delight. He was the station manager. He looked after all the things in the office, and then he'd do the bulletins at night. But because he was drinking, he'd do the 8 o'clock bulletin, and the 9 o'clock bulletin would be pre-recorded. So when we came to the 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock and 12 o'clock bulletin, you just repeat the tape is recorded. If the Queen had died at 11 o'clock, our listeners wouldn't have found out until the following morning.
And that brings us to the end of the Radio Bingo Show. Don't forget, those results of tonight's Radio Bingo game are now broadcast at 8:45 tomorrow evening.
Well, it's like a castle with an extra tower, a turret, that goes up about, 600 feet with offices and so on. As you look at it, it's a beautiful building, it is, and the car park in front of it. And you've got a porter's lodge. And the side of the porter's lodge, you've got a moat. So it really was a castle in the past. You go through a TV studio, or underneath the TV studio, down a corridor, and then in a lift, you've got two floors, and you'd be on the English service level. Below the English service studio was a German studio and a French studio. So RTL was in all those countries. They had a big thing going in Germany, a big thing going in France, and little 208 at night in England. People probably felt in those days its days were numbered, or its nights were numbered, because Radio 1 had come along. The pirates had set the level of creativity. Luxembourg, with its 208 medium wave AM signal, couldn't possibly survive. That's what people thought. But it came to its halcyon days. It came into its own, because it inherited pirates who knew how to be DJs and a new policy of music. Before I went out there, Radio Luxembourg used to have sponsored shows. The record companies themselves would take a half-hour programme.
Oh, it's Saturday. Yes, it's Saturday.
Yes, and howdy, record fans. Once again, it's time for another roundup of all your favourite British and American recording artists. And they're brought to you by the Decca Record Company for your special delight tonight.
Now, you can imagine a record company. They'd play everything they got, the crap as well as the good records. And we wouldn't realise that before the pirates. It was music, What was a bad record? There was no such thing. But as we got more into pop music and top 20s, so the British public became sophisticated listeners. They wanted a better quality. And Radio Luxembourg changed its act. We had a playlist with much better music on. There were still problems. They published music. They had B-side deals and things like that. But it was better. And we had Noel Edmonds came out. It was his first radio gig. And then a young 16-year-old Kid Jensen came in from Canada.
When 208 News ends, music instantaneously begins on The Tony Prince Show. Gonna dedicate this record to you, kid, and your face.
Oh, fuck you.
Ow.
What's it called?
Funny Funny.
What?
It hasn't changed a bit in 4 months, I'll tell you. Welcome back to the Tony Prince Show, everyone. It's Friday.
So we've got the nucleus of our team. Dave Christian, young English lad, never been on radio before. So it was a fabulous group of people, and we became blood brothers because you're living in the centre of Europe. There's no EEC. There's few people who speak English. There's few people who are English. Our friends became the Marines from the American Embassy, the crew on Air Bahama, a flight that went to Nassau with Americans. And we just start going out together. This is what made Radio Luxembourg quite different than the BBC. The pirates had had a touch of it. We all became mates because we were thrown together. We actually liked each other, supported each other, promoted each other, went out, had fun with each other. And then the record companies started coming out. When they saw the DJs had hit picks and could choose their own records, they started coming out with their groups. You know, whether it was Queen, Status Quo, Steve Harley, Paul Simon, Neil Sedaka, oh, the list is endless. They all came out to Luxembourg.
We have many listeners in Great Britain, and we have many, many more listening around the world, and it's a very nice situation. We heard the other day, we just had a survey done in Scandinavia, and we hear that on average, 40% of the people in Scandinavia, that's Sweden, Denmark, Norway, and Finland...
You know, although in hindsight you had a hell of an audience, and your mail showed you that, it wasn't just Britain. You could even go to Iceland, actually, but let's start at Scotland... to Luxembourg, and then run that compass round, and there you've got the signal reach, because Radio Luxembourg was a directional rig. It threw itself up into the ionosphere, bounced off the ionosphere, and then came down, and it came down with all that static, and worse in the summer because there's more sunlight and the sun affects the journey of the signal, if you like. In the winter, some areas had a beautiful signal. 50 million, you know, maybe more.
We've just had reports confirming the death of Elvis Presley, who died in Memphis at the age of 42. He was rushed to a hospital in Memphis.
Mark Wesley was on air. He walks down the studio. We used to get the news from the Daily Mirror. It came on a telex, and then you read it yourself. There was no newsreader. The DJs all read their own news. Mark Wesley has walked towards me and said, "Tony, have you heard the news?" I said, "What's that?" He said, "Elvis is dead." It couldn't possibly be true, could it, you know? He said, "Read this," and he gave me the bulletin, and there it was from the Daily Mirror, authenticated. Elvis was dead. I'm on air now in 15 minutes. Mark's taken the script. He's gone off to get himself ready to read the news just before I come on air, play his last few records. I've run downstairs, two floors. I've gone down a corridor. I've gone to the English office. I've opened my locker. In that locker, I've got all my Elvis records in one area. I've carried these LPs and singles upstairs, rushed up. I'm on air now in 5 minutes. I've gone into the engineer's side. We weren't self-op in those days. We had an engineer behind a glass panel, and we were alone in the other room. Mark's now coming into his news bulletin. I've put the records down. I've got the greatest hits. I've gone next door. I've opened the door quietly because Mark is now reading the news. I've pulled the door behind me quietly. Mark has announced that Elvis is dead. And that was it. Mark hands up now over to Tony Prince. And then I read a little bit of the bulletin again and announced that Elvis was dead. I'm afraid it's true.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Tony Prince. 15 minutes ago, I walked into the studio here in Luxembourg, and Mark Wesley imported the news on me that the Daily Mirror had confirmed to him that Elvis Presley has died in the United States of America. Well, maybe you know, maybe you don't know, that this radio station was the first radio station in Europe to ever feature the man and his music. Maybe you also know that I am probably one of his biggest fans in the world. I met him twice.
I knew this was a moment in history. I wasn't nervous. I wasn't emotionally wrecked. I was aware that I had a duty to do right by Elvis and do this evening. Open the phone. I know the fans intimately. I've been to too many Elvis conventions. I've been on trips with them 3 times. I've been to his home in Tupelo, his birthplace. Graceland's. We've been to Vegas, to the Hilton Hotel twice. I've gone backstage. Colonel Parker's let me go on stage and introduce the Elvis show. So everything a kid from Oldham, who was 14 years of age, with a picture of Elvis on his bedroom wall, couldn't have done more as a fan. So here I am, with all that history of a relationship with the King, and I had to get through that show. So that's all I could think of. I just held myself together. We opened the telephone lines. What I was worried about was these poor fans. Some of them are real fanatics. Real fanatics. And it went through my head, there's going to be some suicides tonight if we don't watch it here. So I had to address that. I got Todd Slaughter on the phone after a couple of hours, which was very difficult. Fan club secretary, I mean, everybody in the world wanted to talk to him. But I eventually got Todd on air and we concurred that, you know, the kids have got to keep their strength of following of Elvis. Don't do anything silly. I know some of you will be tempted to do something silly, but Elvis now needs you more than ever, because you're going to stick around, and Elvis needs people like you right now. So that was the kind of message we were putting over. The end of the 4 hours, I've now got to take my Elvis records back downstairs. The station's off the air. We've closed it down. I've taken the records back to the office. I now walk down the cold, lonely Heartbreak Hotel street, and there's a bar just closing. Must be about 5 a.m. Luxembourg time. And I go in, and the bar manager is a mate of mine. I have a couple of whiskies, and then I skedaddle and go to my hotel. It's now maybe 5:30. I now phone Christine, my wife in England. I know she'll have been listening, but I know she won't have stayed the course. It was a long night. So I wake Christine up, and the minute she says, "Oh, I'm so sorry, Tony," I break down and cry like a baby. I cried and cried and cried, and every time I tried to speak, I cried again. But now it was a flood. It was just unbelievable. I couldn't stop crying. And God bless her, Christine just cradled the phone and just cooed me. Come on. Anyway, the end, 20-minute call, I stopped crying, said, "Sorry to wait, babe, good night." And that was it. That was the end of my Elvis night.
It's exactly midnight on Radio Luxembourg, August the 16th, 1977. The day and the year of Elvis Presley's death.
Radio Luxembourg!
I mean, I have to be candid and honest and say I did as many audition tapes as you could possibly do for the BBC. And then there was a Eurovision Song Contest, and the whole of the BBC came out to Luxembourg, and we had a party afterwards in the Holiday Inn. And I ran into the controller, Douglas Muggeridge. I ran into Douglas Muggeridge, got on like a house on fire. Doreen Davis was there. But Douglas said to me, "Look, Tony, next time you're in London, come and see me." God, blimey, I nearly beat him to London. It was just a drag living in the centre of Europe when, you know, King's Road was just across the water. And we were true blood Brits living in the centre of Europe before the common market. And, you know, as Paul Burnett would concur, there were lots of grey days. There was lots of technicolour and colourful days and incredible memories with these great celebrities coming out to party with you. But when they went, and you weren't on the BBC, and you knew the Radio 1 Roadshow was on the way, and you should be on that stage with them, you did get depressed. So I pretended I got some gigs, and so I went to Broadcasting House. Here I am now walking through the hall where so many legends have walked over the years, and I just felt this is right, you know. I could really function in here, you know. So I went up to see Douglas. I was taken into his office. We had tea and biscuits, and we had a very, very informal chat. And then as I'm, he said, "Well, thank you for coming in, Tony. I do appreciate it." And he stood up and shook my hand. And as he's walking me to the door, he said, "I'll tell you something. I think you will have a far longer career at Radio Luxembourg than these DJs at the BBC Radio 1. Why he said that, whether he'd had a Barney with one of his producers because he's inviting me in, you know, that thought ran through my head later. Maybe, you know, sometimes when your boss, who shouldn't be programme director, invites a DJ in, the real programme director gets pissed off, you know. Maybe that's what happened. And it came to my mind there and then that I'm going to have to spend my career with Radio Luxembourg and see where that leads. And stop sending audition tapes and courting the BBC because they obviously don't want me. My only regret is that I never got on Top of the Pops. You know, I wanted my mum to see me on Top of the Pops. And you could only get on Top of the Pops if you were on the BBC.
Radio Luxembourg, 208, Great Britain.
Then Alan Keane asked me if I'd be programme director. Ken Evans was leaving, going to the BBC. Alan wanted a new programme director, and he'd obviously seen something in me. And I said to Alan Keane, Alan, are you crazy? I'm a DJ. I haven't finished being a star DJ yet. But the big magnet was Alan said, you come back to live in England, but you do 2 weeks in London and 1 week in Luxembourg. I said, that sounds great. As long as I can bring my two kids and my wife back to this beautiful country, I'll do whatever you want. And that's what happened. Yeah, ILR was blossoming. I knew that there was going to be a lot of competition, you know. So when I became programme director, what was my frame of mind? There was one flaw in the playlist philosophy. Radio Luxembourg had a publishing company. They did nasty, sneaky B-side deals. A record company would come in and offer them publishing on the B-side, which would never be played on the radio. But I don't know whether anybody knows this, but if you've got the B-side publishing and an A-side sells a million copies, you get half of the publishing. You get your share of that record sale. But it was good income, and they did B-side deals. And I wanted that to stop. I said, I'm not saying we're not going to do any publishing deals, but I want to approve them. I really must approve them. And the big test was John Reed was the guy who was running the publishing company then. Came into me one day. He had Baccarat, Yes Sir, I Can Boogie. I said, get out of here. It's not coming anywhere near my playlist. Get out of here. He came in the following week. He said, God, have another listen. I said, I've heard it. I don't want to listen. It's awful. It's a European Eurovision cheap record. It's awful. Go away. So he came in the next week. He said, Tony, not again, John. He said, look, listen to me out. If we get on the top 75 of Music Week, will you put it on the playlist? I said, OK, thinking it hadn't got an earthly. The following week, it went in the top 75. I had to playlist it and it became a bloody big hit. How embarrassing. I used to get letters from listeners who complained because they thought Stuart Henry was drunk on air. So I called Stuart over, I talked with Alan Keane, I've got an idea. So we called Stuart over with Ollie, his wife. I said, Stuart, we'd sent him to a specialist in Germany. When the BBC sacked him, and they sacked him because he used to walk with a sailor's gait through Broadcasting House. And the reason he walked with a sailor's gait was because he had the first signs of multiple sclerosis. They thought it was because he smoked marijuana, which he did and which a lot of people did. And they fired him.
And the weather tomorrow, it's going to be cloudy today with rain at times, I'm afraid. An expected high of 10 degrees centigrade, that's 50 Fahrenheit. Stuart Henry in Luxembourg.
We sent him to a specialist in Germany who identified MS. So we knew why his voice was trailing and suffering speech defect. But the listeners didn't know that. Stuart wouldn't come out of the closet. So we called him over, we took him to Wheeler's across the road, we had a lovely meal. I said, Stuart, the reason we brought you in, we want you to come out of the closet. We want you to tell people you've got multiple sclerosis because I'm getting letters from people who think you're drunk. Now, you know you're not. I know you're not, but they don't know you're not, and that's not fair on the listeners. So what I'm proposing is that to come out in a really great way and to do good for your disease, we'll start the Stuart Henry Multiple Sclerosis Appeal. We've talked with the MS Society and they're right up for it. Sold. Stuart came out of the closet. We extended his career. The minute the public knew, there were no more letters. But his voice got worse and worse. He was wheelchair bound. We bought him a contraption for Ollie to have in a car where a hook came out, lifted his wheelchair, lifted him up in a harness and sat him in the car. I brought Ollie in, his wife, who would never have been a DJ. So it became the Stuart and Ollie show. So again, we extended his life longevity as a broadcaster.
That's their very first single, you know. I think they can be proud of it, all right. Out of Norwich, that's Test Card F on the Backs record label with Band...
My job to find new DJs. Mike Reed was a disaster area. I knew he was auditioning for the BBC left, right and centre. You know, I had friends at the BBC now. And he kept missing flights. He'd do a gig, he'd miss a flight. I'd given him two warnings. I said, it can't happen again, Mike. But it did. It happened a third time. And he phoned me up. He said, I know you're going to sack me. He said, but can I ask you a favour? Please don't sack me for a week. He said, because as you've probably guessed, I've been to the BBC for an interview and I think I've got the job. If you announce this now, it might hinder my cause. So I agreed not to announce anything, and he did indeed get the job. Steve Wright, he's another one I found down in Reading, and a brilliant broadcaster. Radio Luxembourg. We'd inherited a new hierarchy. There was a lot of politicking going on. Sir John Rogers was brought in to give us a voice in Parliament. Patrick Cox, his father had been one of the bosses at ATV or ITV. He wasn't a pop man at all, but he was running the company. I mean, that's why Alan Keane was taken off the board, because of Patrick's manoeuvring, political manoeuvres. And I'm stuck with this guy. And it's very, very difficult. Life is not fun at 38 Hartford Street. I'm clinging on for dear life. Now, I used to listen to every tape I received from wannabe DJs, because I was one myself once who sent audition tapes. And I knew how important it was to a kid to receive a response to something they'd sent you. So I always did, I always listened. But one tape I received didn't have a voice on it, just had music. And then after a couple of weeks, I decided to have another. Had I missed something? Had I played the wrong side of the tape? So I'm driving down the M4 in my car, and that's where I listen to a lot of audition tapes. I'm heading home, and I listen to this tape, and it suddenly struck me, this guy wasn't your traditional DJ. He was mixing tracks, one after the other, in beat alignment, in perfect 16 bars, 16 bars. It was just perfect. I thought, my God, this is stimulating. Non-stop music. I wonder whether he could do me a medley. So I'd inherited a couple of dance programmes, the Top 20 Disco Import Show and the Disco Top 30. I invited this kid, he was a kid from Wales, and I gave him my idea. So I've got this dance music programme, I want a mix every week. So we started playing Alan's mixes, and I started getting letters from club DJs who wanted clean copies of these mixes so they could play them in their clubs. Then I got the idea. I was looking for an out, and I think I'd got it. I went to see Maurice Oberstein, who'd become a great friend of mine. He was chairman of the BPI, and he was the managing director and chairman of CBS, which became Sony. And I went out for lunch with him, which I did quite often. How do you like this? You, at the moment, maintain a dance music department. They've got to keep tabs on all the club DJs around the country. You've got to send those great club DJs your records. You've got to maintain the playlist. You've got to maintain a promotion department for dance music, not just for radio. It's expensive. What if I told you I could send your records to DJs without it costing you a penny? I said, if you and your other labels will allow me to mix records together, the DJs will buy that. And on the back of that, we'll send them another cassette of new releases, which you can choose. So Maurice arranged for me to go to the BPI. There was a committee meeting there with all the gods of industry. I took Christine with me to show them that she was going to be the club secretary and run the thing. So we got the world's first DJ-only record licence from the BPI, which eventually got handed over to the PPL. And Luxembourg was heading towards the end of its days anyway, so there was a lot of reasons for me to try and bail out and get something else for my life. So when this idea of the tape came up, I knew I could make a living out of this. I knew how good the mixing was. I knew how thirsty the DJs were to get these. So we started the Disco Mix Club. By now, I told Patrick, I know you want me out. Let's have a deal. Come on, play the right hand of cards with me here. You've got to give me a farewell handshake. I've been here 16 years.
This is Mike Hollis saying thank you, and may Radio Luxembourg live on forever in your fondest memories.
Maybe the morning will find the sun shining.
So in the end, I think I got 2 years' salary and a handshake, and that was it. But the part of the deal was I'd carry on recording on Luxembourg for a year. So I thought I got a good deal. I got out of Luxembourg without it being an instant guillotine on my career with them. And I got this amazing promotion on Luxembourg to play mixes. And then other DJs started sending me their mixes. And they came from Holland and everywhere around Europe. And it just, boom! Disco Mix Club is now DMC. We don't refer to the word disco anymore because it sucked for a while, you know. It's been going 30 years now. 30 years, and Christine and I are still running it. With our family, you know, my son runs a magazine from Ibiza. Gabrielle used to do all the graphics. It's just gone on and on and on, and it won't go away. You know what? Let's just think about this. It all goes back to the Butlins and the Boot and singing with Rory Storm and the Hurricanes and Ringo Starr. Music was in my soul. That's when it began. Loving Elvis, Heartbreak Hotel. That's when it began. The music, when I stood before the Musicians Union and said, every DJ is a musician. I've proved it now. Because our company is built with DJs who took mixing to remixing to making original productions with Beyonce and superstars and so on. The big name DJs are now the artists. And it all began because I understood how creative mixing records could be. And then they got the drum machine and other gadgets that brought music into their life. And then they got computer programs. And the DJs just advanced and advanced and advanced. And I don't know where he goes from here. All I know is I've done all I can. My passion for the DJ has evolved into the Disco Mix Club and the World DJ Championships. I've had a life fulfilled. I'm not excited. I'm still looking for the next leaf in the book. What's next? Everything I've done in my life has been based on an idea. Waking up in the morning, that's when I'm really vibrant, the first hour of wake. And those ideas come tripping into my mind. Or I'll be out driving in the car and suddenly an idea will come. I can't say what Tommy would have thought. Because it would have been too egocentrical for young Tommy to think of so many great things, even meeting Elvis, you know, starting the World DJ Championships. Comparing Paul McCartney's Buddy Holly Week for 12 years with Paul and Linda. There's so many great things happened to Tommy that he couldn't have imagined it. And, you know, I still look back, I'm not big-headed about anything I've done. It's just been a wave I've been carried on. I've enjoyed it so much. I've enjoyed bringing pleasure. I've enjoyed being creative and inspiring other people to be creative. If you don't mind, I prefer not to be remembered and just live a little bit longer. I'm not ready to be remembered yet.
Thank you.